The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We are living in an age of citizen power. The Arab Spring, Occupy Wall Street, the Tea Party, Black Lives Matter, and the Standing Rock protests are evidence of frustration becoming action. The rise of Bernie Sanders and Trump Nation speak to what can happen when long-held assumptions about power are rejected. Too many Americans are profoundly illiterate and willfully so about power, says Eric Liu. Liu's TED Talks about citizen power and voting have been viewed more than 2 million times. And on Friday, he'll be at the Courier Museum of Art to talk about his new book, You're More Powerful Than You Think. Eric is founder and CEO of Citizens University and a former policy advisor and speechwriter for President Clinton. Here with a little taste of what he'll be talking about in Manchester. And Eric, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Virginia, thank you for having me.
Power is a gift, you tell us. So we endow people and officials and brands and organizations with power. So how does understanding this endow people with power?
You know, I think it's really important to, in the first place, just define our terms. When I talk about power, I mean simply a capacity to ensure that others do as you would like them to do. And I'm sure for some listeners that definition is a little bit menacing, domineering sounding, but I really want you to sit with that, because when you're honest about it, in every circle of relationship in our lives, whether it's family and friends, neighborhood and community, politics and national activity, we are always, constantly, as humans, trying to get other people to do what we'd like them to do. And it's that capacity applied to public issues, to civic life and common issues, that I focus on in this book in thinking about civic power. And one of the things that I really do believe fundamentally is that, as you say, power is a gift. It is something that we all have and all can generate, and it is something that most of us most of the time throw away. We give it away. We give it away by not participating. We give it away by not paying attention. But in all these different ways, if we become mindful of the ways in which we actually generate different forms of power, whether that's people power, ideas power, the power to change social attitudes and norms, when we are mindful of that, we begin to gather it up again and become more conscious of how we're going to intentionally circulate and apply that power toward common ends rather than just, again, throw it away or give it away.
Well, we know that election 2016 was thought to be the triumph of those who felt disenfranchised and powerless. And you've been across the country talking to people across the political spectrum, I should add, and observed that the Pottersville flip, this is a reference to the two destinies for one town in that Jimmy Stewart film, It's a Wonderful Life. Now, first of all, what do you mean by that, the Pottersville flip?
Yeah, I think this is a nice little exercise of imagination. Anybody who's seen It's a Wonderful Life knows the general conceit that this idyllic little town, Bedford Falls, is a town where people are helping each other out and looking out for each other, and there's a spirit of mutual responsibility in there. But when George Bailey gets his wish fulfilled that he'd never been born, the fabric of that town turns out to have unraveled, and it's no longer Bedford Falls. It becomes Pottersville, named after the oligarch in town, the one guy who controls the banks and the real estate and everything else, and it becomes a town where he concentrates all power and monopolizes it, and everyone else lives in essentially slums. And so the mental exercise is to say, wherever your town falls on that spectrum, I invite you to imagine flipping to the other side. If you happen to still be fortunate enough to live in a place that is kind of like Bedford Falls, really think about what it would be like if your town became Pottersville overnight. And in the other direction, especially, if you live in a town that has become Pottersville for various reasons, the jobs have been outsourced, it's whatever it might be, I invite you to imagine what would it take to get yourselves back to Bedford Falls. And it's not just a matter of excluding people, it's a matter of rebuilding trust. It's a matter of actually inviting people in, but with a different mindset and attitude. And that work of imagination is what has to precede any exercise of civic power.
Well, this leads to your ideas on the laws of power. First one, power compounds. So that's Mr. Potter pulling in all the assets, creating a sort of dynasty of his own. And number two, power justifies itself. Now, how do we see that in action?
We see that in action in so many ways. I mean, it's propaganda. It's just rationalizations. It's just so stories about, you know, why the wealthy are wealthy and why everyone else isn't. It's stories about why, you know, in other eras, why men should have control of political and economic institutions and women aren't suited for these things. All of these are narratives that justify the people who already have power. And if all we had was laws number one and number two, which is to say, number one, power compounds, it concentrates, it tends toward these monopolistic winner-take-all situations. And number two, power is constantly justifying itself. If all we had were these two laws, we'd be stuck in a terrible doom loop and tipping toward tyranny and monopoly. But what saves us, fortunately, especially in a country like ours, where at least nominally, theoretically, we are supposed to have a democracy, is law number three, and that is that power is infinite. You know, I don't mean that we're all equally powerful, that we all at all times can do anything we want, and I certainly don't mean that we all have infinite bank accounts or anything like that. I mean simply this, that any one of us, I don't care what your bank account is, I don't care what your last name is, can generate new power out of thin air. And we do that simply through the magic act of organizing other humans. That generates new power in a way that can change the game of politics and community life.
So that's what power is. And your message is, of course, about that, how loads of stories in the book about people and groups reclaiming their power from tomato pickers in Immokalee, Florida, to organizing in Glasgow to New Zealand. Now, these are not necessarily huge mass movements.
You know, you at the outset, you named some of the big movements of our time, whether it is, you know, the Tea Party or Occupy Wall Street. There are lots of organized movements like that, but a lot of what I'm writing about in this book is just as you said. It's stories of everyday citizens who are deciding to take some action in concert with others to change something. And these aren't big news-making movements. These are a decision to say, you know what, we want to make sure that the parks in our town are open longer. We want to make sure that the water in our town is actually safe to drink. Whatever it might be, that these are people who are organizing themselves in ways that are often off the grid of the national media, but it's this bottom-up exercising of citizen muscle that even when times are tough and even in communities that have been hit hard economically, there is so much more capacity and what you might think of as just civic wealth that's not getting tapped by people who in fact, when they're activated, can make a big difference.
I'm speaking with Eric Liu. He is the author of the book More Powerful Than You Think, and it is about how people give power away and how they can become more literate in power and use it to their own advantage, especially for the good of the whole. Well, I'd like to look at that because there's a story that you write about Nancy Malarkey. She's reading in the local newspaper about landlords refusing to rent to low-income people. And she brings it to her church, which she's active in, and gets people to help show up at these town council meetings. But we're talking about two things. Reading in a local paper, has a church group that she's active in. That feels a little old school. What is networking like, and what is bringing your resources to bear when a lot of people, you know, consider the limits of activism, pressing that they like something or support it on Facebook?
That's an interesting question. You know, I think social media and technology can be great tools. A lot of the organizing of our times wouldn't be happening and happening as fast as it does without things like Facebook. But what Facebook is dangerous, why it's dangerous is that it really corrodes our old habits of seeing each other. And I think all civic power that's durable is built face-to-face. You know, I don't know if the paper, the story she read about how local landlords were refusing to rent to potential tenants who had Section 8 vouchers, I don't know if she read that online or if she read that in print. Maybe someone did forward it to her by email, or she saw it on Facebook. But wherever she saw it, she had to go to her, you know, her analog group, which is to say her church, where she had to go and see people and talk to people and point to the banners in that church that said, you know, home for all people, and actually say, are we going to live up to that creed or not?
But have they really changed the game? I mean, we've heard a lot of stories of ordinary Americans talking about how hard it is to pay for catastrophic medical bills, or retirees who lost their life savings or their home in the financial crisis. I mean, wages have been flat in the United States for 40 years. And it is since then, the financial collapse, especially, that wealth is going to the top 1%. It's soaring. So have the numbers really changed that game?
Not yet, I guess, is my short answer. we are seeing everything from the Tea Party to Occupy Wall Street to the Bernie Sanders campaign to the Donald Trump campaign. These are all symptoms of the deeper disease that you've just named here, which is we've had four decades of some of the most radical concentration of wealth and severe inequality in this country since just before the Great Depression. And you can't go for four decades letting one percenters rig the tax code so that wealth flows upward to the already wealthy. You can't have four decades of unchecked globalization sending jobs from the United States to low-wage places around the world without there being tectonic earthquakes and volcanoes in our politics. And that's the moment we're in right now, where eruptions are happening and people are saying, you know, we're tired of being ground down like this, right? And whether from the left or the right, or people who don't even put themselves in those kinds of boxes, that's the phase we're in today. And when I say not yet, I just mean we now get to decide, what are we going to do with this? Are we in fact going to change our policies on health or on financial security? These are open questions that we, essentially, the people, are going to be the authors of. We are going to decide, and how we decide that is determined by whether we decide to show up and participate and keep the pressure on. And it's not just a one-round thing. You know, there might be some people who think that the remedy is a repeal of the Affordable Care Act. There will be some people who think that the remedy is an expansion of the Affordable Care Act. But whatever your policy preference is, this is a time where standing on the sidelines and saying, you know, I'm helpless as these great forces around me squeeze me down, that time has passed.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And we're continuing the conversation with Eric Liu. He's a former policy advisor for the Clinton White House and now author of the book, You're More Powerful Than You Think. Before the break, he talked about how ordinary citizens can generate and spread and leverage their civic power through community organization. When you're laying out strategies in the book, some of them have to do with inclusion and diversity. And I wonder what inspiration you can give for us here in New Hampshire. Like all of the country, we have a growing diverse population, but are still predominantly white. And the diversity that a lot more people are probably likely to recognize here is economic diversity. The chasms between which, you know, people don't always cross, or they're not comfortable crossing.
One of the people who I cite in my book is this really well-known community organizer named Marshall Ganz. And Marshall Ganz talks about activating citizen power using these three connected stories, a story of self, a story of us, and a story of now. And what he means by that is you've got to be able to tell, as an organizer, both tell your own story, but also ask people to tell their story about where they came from, what their values are, what matters to them. But once you do that, you got to widen the circle. Well, what's the story of us? Right? How do you define us? In a place like New Hampshire, you might define us in terms of white, non-white, or you might define it in terms of, you know, native born to the state versus not native born to the state. However you define that us, you have to be intentional about where you draw that circle. And then the third story, the story of now, is how do you make clear that this moment today is a pivot point in the history of your community and a time for all these stories to align. Now, candidate Obama in 2008 was really good at running a through line between his story of self, his story of us, and his story of now. Here was a guy who was Kenyan and Kansan. That's his self story. who was embodying an emerging America that was inclusive and multicultural and yet still wedded to our creed in a patriotic way. That was his story of us. And then his story of now was, it's a time for change. Generationally, this country needed a reboot. And that story worked for him then. But you know who else did it really well? Donald Trump in 2016. He told a story of self, which was basically, I'm a disruptor. I don't play by anybody's rules, and yet I win. And then he told a story of us that was basically, we as a people have been taken advantage of by too many people for too long, and we need this kind of disruption, and the game has been rigged. And his story of now equally was about a sense of urgency that if we decide not to tolerate just incrementalism anymore, we can make a big change now. He lined up those three stories, again, really effectively. Now, I make no comment about the other dimensions of his campaign, but I will say on that, he lined up those stories that way. And I think that's super important if you're trying to recognize in a changing community like New Hampshire, how do you include people, right? And my general watchword in civic power is you've got to be exercising your power in a way that's bringing more people into the fold. That's the bottom line. Are you inclusive or not? Are you trying to hoard power for people you define as part of your us, whatever that may be, or are you trying to circulate it more widely? My general watchword is don't be a hoarder. And I think if we circulate and if we have an ever more inclusive notion of who gets to share power, it's not about a zero-sum thinking that if you invite newcomers in and they get a say that you're somehow weaker. No, we're all better off when we're all better off. I think the more healthy a democracy is in a place like New Hampshire with this great New England tradition of small towns governing themselves, the more healthy the country will be.
The thing about writing a book like this and talking about those strategies is anybody can pick them up. So what we've seen in the world is this growing nationalist, anti-immigrant fervor in Europe and in the United States, white supremacist groups on the rise. And I wonder for you, you know, you are a man of Asian descent working here in America, trying to work across the political spectrum. What is that experience like for you when you're watching these kind of groups rise?
Well, I think, you know, it's certainly troubling. It should be troubling for anybody, even if you call yourself white. But for me in particular, you know, I'm the son of immigrants from China. And as a Chinese American, as a second generation American, I come to this work around citizenship and trying to democratize our understanding of power in civic life. I come to it with a very strong second-generation sensibility, which is basically this. All I did was have the dumb luck to be born in the United States. As a second-generation kid, I grew up with this sense of, at all times, earn it. What are you doing to be a contributor? What are you doing to be useful? That shapes my whole worldview, and I think that second-generation sense of, number one, earn it, but number two, don't take anything for granted. When you're the kid of immigrants, you're the first in your family to experience a lot of things as American, and yet you have a very heightened sensibility and sensitivity to the ways in which all those things are fragile, right? I don't take for granted for 1 minute the solidity of our institutions. The health of our democracy, the norms of trust and tolerance and openness and inclusion that make a diverse place go. I don't take those for granted. I feel like we got to tend that garden every day. Finally, I would just say, as an Asian American, you know, I'm very conscious of the ways in which, in ways that are exciting and ways that are very scary for lots of people, we're in a period of time right now where Americanness and whiteness are delinking. That's just the bottom line. I mean, it's the bottom line statistically. We will be in a couple of three decades a country that is majority people of color. But it's also happening and shifting attitudinally in the ways that it's not just that popular culture or politics or public arenas are becoming more diverse and integrated. It's that we are fulfilling our promise of hybridity. The whole point of America is to be generating awesome, unseen hybrids that the rest of the world couldn't have imagined and wouldn't have even tried doing. And so to me, I see the excitement in that. But I also, you know, in seeing this surge of nationalism, nativism, white supremacy, and racism, I'm very conscious of the ways in which that tectonic shift is freaking a lot of people out. And so, again, in my work, I'm trying to reground people in a bigger story of us, that there's a story of Americanness that doesn't have to be attached just to whiteness. It's a story of our creed, and it's a story of hybridity, and it's a story of doing stuff the rest of the world can't do. And I think that's a story that other people can join, whether they call themselves white or not.
Eric Liu, founder and CEO of Citizens University and author of the new book, You're More Powerful Than You Think. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's been so great. Thank you very much.
Eric is going to be talking about the book at the Courier Museum of Art in Manchester on Friday evening, April 21st at 6. And we want to give a shout out to Constitutionally Speaking, which is presenting the event in partnership with the New Hampshire Institute for Civics Education and New Hampshire Humanities. More information at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like it, please write a review, please pass it along, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio. Pretend we're just lovers, but I